Okay, we'll move on to our next section in our study, which is on God's Big Promise, which is going to deal with Abraham and the setting up of Abraham's family and the promises that are related to this. So we start off with why. Why study this big story? What is important for us? And granted, as I think I probably said this before, we could probably find a reason any of these stories in the Old Testament are recorded and why they have some importance. But for us, why would we say this is important? Well, it provides us background for God's relationship with Israel. And it also, and I would add one other thing that there's no room to add on that line, but it also demonstrates something about the relationship between Abraham's faith and our faith. And we will get to that probably not tonight. I marked where we're going to stop tonight, but yeah, we're not going to get there. Not by my plans anyway. So those are the two reasons I would suggest. Now let's take our Bibles and let's turn to Joshua 24 and let's take a quick gander at part of Abraham's past that some people pick up. Some people don't really focus on this a great deal, but I think it's important for us to understand this. Joshua chapter 24, this is, remember, at the after the conquest of the land. In Joshua 24, verse 2, it says, "And Joshua said to all the people, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, from ancient times your fathers lived beyond the river, Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods.'" And then if you go on down to verses 14 and 15, it says, "And now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt." That, by the way, is important because it's showing you that they still were bowing down to Egyptian gods that they had. And this is at the end. This is not only 40 years that they've been in the wilderness, but also the time of the conquest. And they've still had some of these. We know this by Stephen tells us this over in Acts, that the whole time they wandered through the wilderness up through the conquest, they were carrying with them the tabernacle of Rampha, which was one of the gods of North Africa and the Egyptians, and they brought that with them. There were two Egyptian gods that, and I don't remember what the other one was, but there was a second, there were two of them that Stephen says they carried with them the whole time, even though they were being told not to make idols. Well, it doesn't say they were making, but they were carrying along some idols they brought with them. Joshua is telling them, put those away. So don't serve the gods that your fathers served. That would have been Abraham and his father back then in the past, as well as the ones you served when you were in Egypt. And serve the Lord. And if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, well, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So they were going to serve God. They weren't going to serve these false gods. That was the call at this. But this passage is important because it's reminding us that when God appears to Abraham, and let's go over to Genesis chapter 15. When God appears to Abraham, Abraham doesn't have, from an earthly perspective, a whole lot going for him by which you would say, hey, this is the ideal candidate for me to start my special work with. Number one, you're dealing with a man that has come from a family of idolaters. And there's actually no particular indication as of Genesis 15 that Abraham isn't an idolater even at this point. He's had contact with Jehovah, but there's no evidence that he wasn't practicing some idolatry at this point. The second thing is God's going to build a nation, and he comes to a man, if you look in these opening verses of Genesis 15, verse 1, "After these things, then the word of the Lord," that's God the Son, okay, "came to Abraham in a vision, saying, 'Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great.'" Now, "don't fear, Abram, and I am a shield to you" goes right back to the War of the Kings that just happened in chapter 14, where, remember, Lot was carried off. There was a War of the Kings that happened with Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities down there, and the kings from the east came. And Abraham took his army. Now, he has an army of 300 fighting men that were raised in his house. So he's got his, could you imagine having your own 300 men fighting force at your disposal? But that's what he had. So he's a wealthy man, but he has no family. And he's an idolater. And God says, don't fear, Abram, because, and he just calls him Abram. Abram is the term meaning exalted father or high father. It's kind of an ironic title, since he's not even a father at this time. Verse 2, and Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Again, shows you something of their culture. Had he died, Sarah would not have inherited his property. It would have gone to the steward or the manager of his household. So he had a manager. And Abram said, since you have given me no offspring, one born in my house is my heir. And then behold, the word of the Lord, again, God the Son came to him saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body. Not an adopted child, not an heir that's been raised in your family, but your own child shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars. If you were able to count them, he said to him, so shall your descendants be. So he's saying, you're going to eventually your seed will be this big. But right now, Abraham is nothing. So there's two things against Abram. Number one, he's not prodigious in terms of children. So he's not ideal for starting a nation. Okay. Number two, it's a nation for God, and he's an idolater from what we just saw with Joshua up to this point. Now, if you turn over to chapter 16, when God makes a statement, one of the things you and I don't get yet, let's put it this way. If God had never said what he says about Sarah and Isaac, and God had left all that out and had gone with Ishmael, probably none of us particularly would have thought a whole lot about that. Most of us probably wouldn't have scratched our heads or looked at that and said, well, Abraham, why'd you and Sarah do that? In there, with them, where God says, no, you're going to have your own child, it made perfect sense to them to, well, why not take Hagar here. She's my handmaid, probably meaning that she was a younger gal than Sarah is at this time, and she's still able to bear children. Well, I have a child through her. That was not uncommon. That was actually a very common, in fact, it's still common in lots of parts of the world today. If you don't have a child, you go have somebody else have the child for you. And so they were doing something that had actually been common and has continued to be to some degree. But in this passage where this transpires with Hagar, with Abraham and Hagar, as much as in our society where we don't practice, where we look down on bigamy, that's really hard for us to appreciate that was acceptable. But they lived in a culture where that wasn't uncommon. It was very common if you were a well-to-do man to have multiple wives. Now, I think when we come to the New Testament, just to say this as an aside, a bishop is to be a one-woman man. So bishops aren't bigamists. Bishops do not have multiple wives. And if he's to be the example for the flock, would you not say that it's probably appropriate that the other people in the church don't practice bigamy also? Yes. Now, I'll add one other detail. What if you are, let's pick on Josh and Faye, what if you are Josh and Faye and you're in a place where sometimes people do have more than one wife and somebody gets saved? Do you say, now to be in the church, you got to get rid of one of those two? I don't think you can find a chapter and verse that says you get rid of wives, but that man is never going to be able to serve in the office of bishop. It's going to be a restriction. He may have the pastor teacher gift, and he may exercise his pastor teacher gift, but never as a bishop. But you don't tell him, get rid of a wife. I mean, I can't imagine a more horrible thing to do to that woman, and on behalf of the testimony of Christ, than to say, kick her to the curb. They probably wouldn't do it. Well, I don't know. They might. It might be that rough. But I say that because there are missionaries traditionally, because European missionaries practiced, like us, not bigamy. They practiced monogamy. They would go to cultures that where there was polygamy, and they would make these men get rid of all their wives but one. And to me, I don't think that was the best policy. I don't have a chapter and verse that says that, but...
They talked about that same problem Paul was saying, but then they just don't have many people to be eligible to be a pastor.
Yeah. pastors or deacons too, because it's also a qualification of a deacon. So it just puts you in a situation. Sometimes what you're doing is you're looking, you're just having to trust God that he'll provide in time. And you're going to have to maybe be faithful and let another generation be raised 40 up.
Years.
What?
40 years.
40 years. It might be. Yeah, it might be. Anyway, with that, with all that extra stuff said, go to chapter 17.
17?
Chapter 17 now. And in chapter 17, when God appears to Abram again and establishes the covenant of circumstances.
What?
Circumcision. I'm sorry.
Circumcision.
I would attribute that to low blood sugar like yesterday morning, but I'm not right now. It's just, maybe I ate too much for supper, too much chili. But anyway. But then in verse 15, then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Now keep in mind, she's pretty old at this time, because in verse 1 of chapter 17, Abraham is 99 years old. Now I calculated this out once. Abraham lives to be 175. So at 99, he's like a 50-year-old man.
Having a midlife crisis
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, seriously. He's about midway through his life. Okay. Sarah is 10 years younger than him. So she's 89 at this time. So she's just 90, just going on 90. And God says, with regard to Sarah in verse 16, I will bless her indeed. I will give you a son by her, and then I will bless her, and she shall be the mother of nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, will a child be born to a man 100 years old? Now, the word, by the way, for laugh in here, as just a fun aside, is the word Isaac, because Isaac, yeah. So he says, he laughs. He says, shall a man be 100 years old? And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? He's like, come on. Can you imagine he's laughing at God? It's kind of like this last passage went over this last week where Paul's arguing with God. I mean, people sometimes are much more blunt with God in ways that I can't imagine being. But then I'm thinking, yeah, I probably have done that, just maybe not in this way. Abraham says in 18, and Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Now, he's not saying let him live, but he said, let him be the one. That's the idea. Let Ishmael be the one. In other words, come on, I'll make it easy on you. Just let Ishmael be the child. And God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son. You shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And he does give blessings to Ishmael in verse 20, but the covenant is going to be in verse 19 with Isaac. The significance of this is to understand God didn't want Abraham and Sarah's help to plan this. It's a reminder of the classic passage in 2 Corinthians 12 where Paul begs God, can't you change my circumstances three times? And God says, no, my grace is sufficient. In other words, God will put us in situations where only he can solve the problem. Okay? Only he can solve the problem. No of mine laying up in bed all night long trying to figure out how in the world can I make this work will solve the problem. Okay? No amount of scanning the papers and for the right job will solve the problem. No amount of hours spent on the computer researching the problem is going to solve. I mean, all of us know this because we all do this kind of stuff, don't we? That we try to solve these things ourselves. And God's going to put us in situations like Abraham, and he does this multiple times through Scripture, where only God can solve the problem. Because that's what God wants us to see. I'm going to show you, I'm going to do something only I can put together. When it's done, you're going to go, only you could have done that. Because I could plan this, but there's no way I would have planned that. I'm just going to share a little thing with you, and I won't give you details on it. But there was something that I was wanting to do, wanting to plan. I was trying to figure out how to do it. And Peg and I had even talked about this last month and kind of batted things back and forth. And just kind of, to be very simple about it, we both concluded we weren't going to do this because we weren't going to spend the money, not because it was going to stress us financially or that we couldn't afford it, but we felt because we've had some other people in the church that have struggled financially, we just thought it'd be a bad example at this time. And just kind of both of us feeling, not only as a pastor, but just as other believers, we needed to set an example for what we were going to do and not make a... And it wasn't like it was a horrible choice. It's not like doing something awful.
We're going to go to Vegas and gamble away a couple grand.
Did you tell them? No. No, that wasn't what it was. But we went through Vegas one time on the airplane, and if I can fly to Vegas the rest of my life, I will, because the ching, 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 ching of the slot machines just at the airport was more than I can handle. Oh, that noise. Anyway, back to the main point. And then just, what was it, Tuesday? I got an email where somebody had something, suggested something, said they wanted to do this thing, and I was like, I said, look at this. I said, wow, can you imagine? I wasn't even praying about it. I wasn't even really saying, God, I want to do something. I was just like, I just said, no, we're not gonna plan anything. We're not gonna do this. And then here, God put something else together. You know, it's not as exotic as what we were planning, but I'm sure it'll be as fun. And it's not going to involve the expenditure. So it's just one of those teeny little examples in life where you see something that God puts together that you couldn't have orchestrated. And I just always appreciate when God does that. And when God lets us expend ourselves trying to make something work, and then God says, I'm going to do this, and you're going to go, oh, okay, well, we'll just put my stuff aside. You always go, this is better. Anyway. Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, I think, demonstrates that. It's not that Ishmael was a bad thing. We castigate them. I mean, you wouldn't believe how many times when I listen to pastors, they were talking about how horrible Abraham was for doing that with Hagar. But again, the thing is, culturally, we don't appreciate the fact it was real common. But what God's saying is, that's not the way we're going to do it. We're not going to do it by you figuring it out some way that you can make it work. We're going to do it by a way that's going to, when it happens, is supernatural. That's important here. My answer to the next question that you had there, or statement, is God didn't want Abraham and Sarah's help, as in the case of Hagar. Now we go on down to the next ones. And I'm just going to, we're not going to look at all these verses. You got them there, because a lot of this is just details, other things. But if you look at this, God starts the covenant with one man with no children and gives the man one son that's the part of the covenant. He doesn't give him 20 sons and the covenant's going to go out through all 20 of them. He does make promises to Ishmael. And Abraham, after Sarah's death, remarries and does have some other children. But the covenant is not through them, and it's not through Ishmael. It's through this one son. So God takes one childless man, gives him one child. That's the focus of this. And then that one child has two sons. By the way, does anybody know how old Isaac was when he had his first kid? 40. He's 40 years old when he had his first child. And that actually is well defined in Scripture, that it was 40 years. Well, he got married when he was 40. How long after that he has first children? I think it's right about 40, if I remember correctly. But he has just two sons. But God takes one of those out and says, no, the covenant's only going to go through this son, not through this. So God keeps it narrow. It's one guy with no kids, gives him one kid, says this is the one, not this other son and none of these later ones. And then that son has two boys, but we're not going to go with both of those. We're going to go with just one. Okay. Then we get down to, so that's Isaac. Isaac has two sons, but only the one. I'm just trying to show you how God's working this in a way that we would say, God, we could have helped this, I don't want to be crass here or anything like that, but God didn't come with Mormons and say, back in the old Mormon days, have 20 kids and we'll get the covenant started that way. He starts it off very much so, just trying to show he's not in any hurry to push everything along. He's going to do it in his time, in his way. Then we come to the next, to Abraham's grandson, Jacob. Now, Jacob has 12 sons and one daughter, okay? So he ends up having 13 kids, and he has them, but he has them by four wives. Now, the wife that has the most is Leah. Leah has six sons and one daughter, okay? Bilhah, which is Let's see, and I might have the order wrong on this. I think Bilhah is Rachel's handmaid, if I remember correctly. Doesn't make a difference, but he has two sons through Bilhah, two sons through Zilpah, and then two sons through Rachel. So he's got essentially two wives and two handmaids that are, so they would, handmaids later on, handmaids would have been considered almost like well, that's not true. They wouldn't have been concubines because, see, you need to understand, he has children through those handmaids, but see, if you were a woman in their culture and you give that handmaid to your husband and you have a child, that child is your child. It's not your handmaid's child. That's your child in that culture. So there are four women involved in this, but in reality, only two mothers from God, from the way the culture worked, okay? That sounds really bizarre to us, but that's the way that culture worked.
Do you think there was some competitiveness between Rachel and Leah?
There was.
Trying to outdo each other, like, okay, I'm not having any more kids here, take my handmaid.
Well, it's precisely what it was. And God actually was being very nice to Leah with having her all those children, because she begged God for that because Jacob loved Rachel. He didn't like Leah. He didn't want to marry her. He got stuck with her. See? She wasn't the one he agreed on. And I just can't imagine what that'd be like to be in a marriage where your husband loves this other person, not you.
Was his firstborn then from Leah?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, most of the early children were from then. And you can go through and you can read the accounts and you can see kind of the order, how they came in that order.
It's weird how a lot of times there's like all these, like, these men that are special are from this lady who's like barren, you know, and then she's blessed with this one child, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many, there's many of the ladies.
Now, with all that, I want to go over to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. And so with regard to this first part here, where he's talking about this matter of Abraham not having a lot of children and the family, that the fact that this family starts slowly just doesn't take off with great abundance. In fact, even stop and think about this. He has 12 sons and one daughter. And yet, including himself, when they go down to Egypt and they count Joseph and Joseph's two sons in Egypt, how many people are there total in that family? 70.
Right.
Total of 70 people. Tells us very important when it tells that in the book of Exodus that they went down 70. That included Joseph and his two sons. So there's 70 in total that are down there. That's even out of all that family. That's not a huge family. From 12 sons, 70 people. It's still this nation is not. They're not becoming a burgeoning people, just exploding all over the place real fast. Now, in the 400 years that they're down in Egypt, we will see that when we get to there not in this study, but in one of the studies down the road, we're going to see that nation becomes very strong. Perhaps in the 400 years they're down there, very likely that they probably had 2.5 million people that walk out of Egypt. That's a lot of people. That's 400 years for that to happen, but still, that's a lot of people. And that is conservative based on roughly what was here. And we know that roughly from how many fighting men, because I think that there was, when they left Egypt, there was about 660,000 fighting men. That's men over the age of 20 that were counted in the census. So if you figure most of those guys over 20 probably have a wife, that means 1.2 people. And if they've got a wife, there's a good chance they probably have at least two kids, maybe five.
2.3 kids.
2.3 kids, yeah, right, yeah. The great American statistic, yeah. I figured somewhere between 2 to 5 kids, I figured. And so you do that, and you can calculate really fast how many people you have down there that come out. So easily 2.5 million people is the estimate. Okay, so they did grow, but it took a long time. And this is significant when you come to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 7. This is the epitome of grace expressed in an Old Testament concept. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any of the peoples. For you were the fewest of all the peoples. In other words, you weren't significant. You weren't this uncountable people that was just massive in number. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, that would be Abraham, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So he says, he says God's doing this, initially chose you, not because you were big. So when he comes to Abraham and chooses him, he doesn't do it because he's a numerous people. He does it because he was small. In other words, because God wanted to show it's me, not you. Number two, and I loved you, not because of something special you had done, but because I'd made a promise to your forefathers, that is Abraham, and I was going to bring him out. Okay. And that's not the only time God makes that statement in Scripture, but that's probably one of the more notable ones. Now, let's go back and let's look quickly at the promises that God made. So let's go back to the book of Genesis, and there's a series of promises. Some of them are covenant promises, and some of them are just promises. What's the difference between a promise and a covenant? It'd be like the difference between you going to somebody and say, I'll buy your car, versus I'll buy your car, where do I sign on the line? In other words, one is an agreement, a promise, and one is a contract. And essentially, a covenant is a type of a contract. Okay? And I just listened to somebody that I, in my opinion, should know better that recently said, no, covenant is not a contract. It's something much more solemn than that. Well, yeah, it was a kind of a contract you made by killing animals, saying, hey, if I break my part of the contract, let me be like these slain animals here on the ground. That's a little bit more solemn than just sign on the dotted line or spit in the hand. But it is nonetheless a contract. It's just that there's an element of it that's more serious. But see, not all covenants were made by cutting animals. There were various types of covenants that were made, but that's kind of the ones we have. So we start off in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. And we have a series of three promises made in these first three verses. Number one, and the Lord said to Abram. Oh, by the way, we didn't. Let me look here at my notes. Oh, no, we haven't got there yet. Okay, that's why. I was thinking I'd skipped over something. It's down here. We'll hit it just a little bit. Okay. And the Lord said to Abram, which remember means exalted father, keep that in mind in just a minute, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to a land which I will show you. So the first thing he promises him is land. So I'm going to take you to a land. Second thing he promises in verse 2, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing. So the next thing he does, he's going to make him a great nation. And the third thing, verse 3, and I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you I will curse, and in you all families of the earth will be blessed. So I would say the third thing is God makes him a source of blessings or curses for others in the world. How you squeeze that on the line? Let's see, how did I put it? I'm going to find to be a source of blessing and cursing to other nations. If you write as small as I do, you can fit that in real easily. So, and I've learned these since I was a young kid, and probably some of you have too, if you've been in churches and in Bible studies, that God promises them land, a nation, or a family, and blessings. Land, family, and blessings. Those are the three things that God promises Abraham here in Genesis 12. Remember, Abraham's an unbeliever at this time. He doesn't get saved until Genesis 15. There's a lot of people that want him saved here, but it is very clear that it's not until Genesis 15:5 that he's righteous, and that is quoted three times in the New Testament to clarify that. So God's making promises to an unsaved man, which is also important in the overall scheme that's to tell us that not all of God's plan and what he's going to be doing with Abraham, it's not all about salvation. It's going to involve some things about salvation, but not all of it is about salvation. Being a great people is not about being saved. Being a source of blessings to people or a source of cursings to people is not strictly about salvation. Okay. And owning land is not strictly about salvation. I forgot that one. So let's go on to Genesis chapter 15. We've already looked at this in just a little bit ago, but verse 5, this is to some degree a repeat of the 12:2, but it's now it's detailed where he says he took him outside. Now look toward the heavens and count the stars. If you were able to count them, he said to them, so shall your descendants be. In other words, if you can count those stars, you could count your kids. But since you can't count the stars, you're not going to be able to count your kids. And obviously not your kids directly, but your progeny. Because his line eventually will become very big. And he says they're going to be uncountable. And then look down in chapter 15, go down to begin with verse 13. And God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. That's talking about being dying, obviously, and you shall be buried in a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the perversity of the Amorite is not yet complete. In other words, we were talking about this, I think, a couple weeks ago. The Amorites weren't yet as bad as they really wanted to be or were moving that way. And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. And on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. That is the land of the Canaanite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. And we've been looking at some of those. Peg and I have been reading about some of those in Exodus lately when you're reading over there. But they're not all included, because some of those they were going to conquer as they expanded out into the land. And even some of them, they were going to expand out and take that land over time. They were going to take it all at once. But this now is a covenant promise of land that has specific boundaries. It's not just generally stand here, look around, you get this land. But it's like, I'm giving you the land of the boundaries, and I'm telling you the boundaries first by rivers, because they kind of defined the boundaries, and second of all by where the people are that you're going to take over their land. Those were two good ways. It'd be like for us today saying, I'm going to give you the land of the Mexicans and the Canadians. We'd know pretty well what they're talking about. Okay, or you could say, I'm going to give you all the land from the Columbia to the Mississippi or something like that. They're defining points, but he's giving them land with specific boundaries. Turn to chapter 17. Chapter 17, and if you look with me at verse 1, now when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you. You shall be the father of a multitude of nations. Therefore, this is the thing I thought I'd forgotten, verse 5, no longer shall your name be called Abram, exalted father, but your name shall be Abraham, father of peoples, or father of nations, father of peoples, most likely. For I will make you the father of a multitude of nations. Okay. So God is promising, he's furthering the promise here, saying that you're going to be the father of nations. Okay. Is everybody able to keep up with all these fill in the blankers here? Okay. I didn't want to make them too dumb, but at the same time, I didn't want to make them too hard, because then that slows us up. Okay. There's one other covenant promise that God establishes in this passage, and he says in verse, he establishes some of the land, because in here, this is actually a smaller portion of the land than we have in Genesis 15, because this land, he says in verse 8, I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession I will give it to you. Now, some people say the land of Canaan included all those other people in there. It was bigger than just the land of the Canaanite. And there might be some validity to that. But overall, this seems to be the promise of a smaller portion of land, meaning God's made two covenants about two different types of segments of land, one of which we can say at this point has been fulfilled, and the other which we'd say is not. That's kind of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But then verse 9, and God said further to Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout your generations. Now, how do you keep this covenant? Well, this is my covenant, which you shall keep. Now he's going to explain it. Up to this point, he already made a covenant about land, back in chapter 15. This is a distinct covenant about land because he says this is the covenant. Now, this is an addition. And I'm not going to go and prove it right now, but in Galatians chapter 3, Paul makes a statement about covenants over there that once you make a covenant, you don't add to it and you don't take away from it. So if and a lot of people, even good dispensationalists, a lot of them say God made a covenant with Abraham and then kept adding promises to it. Well, that would be in violation of the very thing that Paul said you don't do. You don't take away, you don't change it, you don't alter it. The covenant is what it is. You make another covenant. And I don't know why everybody thinks God can only make one covenant with Abraham. But that's, in their mind, I guess one is easier to deal with than to think of four. But verse 10, this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you. In other words, how do you keep the other covenant? I'm going to give you the land. What are you going to do? How do you keep that? There's nothing to keep. There's nothing to guard. It's just God said it. But this is something you can do. It says, between me and your descendants after you, every male among you shall be circumcised. And he goes through and talks about this. And actually, Abraham wasn't circumcised until this point. He's circumcised in verse 24 when he's 99. And when Ishmael is 13 years old, it's one of the ways that we know that Abraham is 13, actually 14, by the time that Isaac comes along. Okay. Ishmael is 14 by the time Isaac comes along. Okay, I didn't say that right. Sorry. But in order to be part of that family that gets that promise, they had to go through circumcision. So in other words, he narrows down how they get to be partakers of the promise. And let me see what I put down there. This promise would be that his circumcised males would be heirs of this promise. That's the way I defined this promise.
So Ishmael was not circumcised then?
And he was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it says in verse 25, he was circumcised. Which is why the Arabs who take their, the Islam who takes their heritage back to Ishmael, that's why they also practice circumcision. Because they believe it was instituted with regard to Abraham. But see, the Islam thinks that the covenant promises that we read that come through Isaac, they think, no, Isaac was the son that was put out of the side. The promises come through Ishmael. So they say the Bible got the story wrong. They got it right. That's the way they handle it. Now turn to Genesis 18. We already read this, but we're going to come back and read it again. Genesis chapter 18, beginning with verse 10. And he said, this is God speaking with Abraham, I will surely return to you at this time next year. Behold, Sarah your wife will have a son. Sarah was listening at the tent door which was behind him. And now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age, and Sarah was past childbearing. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I am old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? So Abraham laughed, and Sarah laughs also. They both laugh about this, saying, shall I indeed bear a son when I am old? Is there anything too difficult? And that word difficult literally is the word wonderful. In other words, is this such a wonderful thing I'm incapable of it? It's too spectacular for me. And is what he asks for the Lord. And at the appointed time, I'll return to you at this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. So God promises, and we already looked at that earlier, that God promised Abraham a son in his old age, his own son. Now, there is one other covenant promise that we are going to save for later. But I've got one last thing that I want to do now. And I just want to see where you're at on here. Just want to look at a similarity here, because this is one of the things we're trying to do. Turn with me over to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I want to draw, and we're not saying this is the same thing. We're just saying there's similarity here. 1 Corinthians 1. Similarity between what God is doing at this moment with Abraham and what God is doing in the church. Keep in mind kind of what God said to Israel about how he started over in Deuteronomy 7, what we read. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and I'm going to begin reading with verse 20. It says, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through his wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks seek for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So, here it is, verse 26, the key verse driving at. For consider your calling, brothers, that there are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, and not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And that is, he's doing that now, but we also have an example of the fact that God was doing something similar in the time of Abraham, where he essentially chooses a man that we would not have said, hey, Abraham's the ideal candidate for your plan, God. We wouldn't have done that. He chose a man that wasn't notable. He wasn't fancy. He did have a lot of cattle. He had 300 fighting men. That all sounds very impressive to us, but he has no family. And he doesn't have a land. They're wanderers. Keep that in mind. They live in tents. You know what that means? That means when your flock moves over this way, you pick your tents up and you move and you go where the flock is. They don't have a homestead with a house put down. Because remember when Abraham's servant goes to get a wife for Isaac and he brings Rebecca back, he takes Rebecca not into the house, takes her into his mother's tent. See, there's still people that are living in tents. Paul tells us that in Hebrews. Abraham never inherited not even a foot worth of that land while he lived. It was all promised for the future for his family. But he never actually took any. He walked all over it, but he never owned a single step of it while he was there. The only land, in fact, does anybody know the only land Abraham actually ever owned? There was one piece of land that he owned.
Burial
site for Sarah. That was about it. That's right. Now also, with one other thing to go with this, and turn over to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. And I've got two passages on this, but we're just going to look at the one here in Matthew chapter 7. And we're doing so mainly just to lay down a principle of generally what God does. Jesus is talking here to Jews, largely an unsaved crowd. And he says, enter by the narrow gate, for gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And many are those who enter it, for the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. And few there are those are who find it. In other words, again, this is simply to establish the point that through history, in God's plan, most of the time, it's always been a few that have actually been. We saw that in Noah's day. What was there? Noah's the only one we know. God saved eight people, but to our knowledge, Noah's the only one that was technically out of the bunch righteous. And maybe two of his older boys were, but we don't know that for sure. Okay. Abraham's day. Abraham's righteous by believing God, but Abraham doesn't always demonstrate righteousness in his life, in my opinion. It's not that he's horrible, but he does some things that I would consider very horrible. And every time we read that, it disgusts my wife to no end when we read those accounts of what Abraham did. But again, small. And Abraham's family is small. And then even when you have, even when you have 2.5 million people that come out of Egypt, how many of those people actually demonstrate themselves to really be believers? Again, not many. Not many of them do. So again, all these are just serving to remind us that in God's plan overall, it's always been a few. It's always been a few. Now, I wouldn't say that this is true for everybody in Reformed theology, but to me, this is one of the places where Reformed theology doesn't honor the Scriptures very well. Because Reformed theology, and again, not all of them say this, but I've come across this in a couple places, and I had two guys I knew when we lived in Iowa City that used to say, in the end, God has to save more than go to hell. Otherwise, God fails. You know? It's almost like he has to score more baskets to win the game. And that's the way Reformed theology. God has to save more than actually go. And yet Jesus is glad that last statement we looked at there in Matthew 7 actually, it seemed to the contrary. Most of them take the way of destruction. Very few actually take the path that leads to life. And it's, and I would say that that's not because God's forcing them. I listened to somebody today that I would think would know better than that. But he actually says that it, God would be to blame in this matter if it were otherwise. It doesn't make any difference what he said, I guess, but I'll just leave it at that. But again, I think so as we're looking at this, this is number one, this is a setup, just to review, this is a setup for what God will be doing with Israel for 2,000 years. Remember, always a good place to kind of think about in terms of the law. If you want an Old Testament timeline, always think of it like this. Abraham, 2,000 BC. Now, that may not be accurate, but it's real close. 2,000 BC. Moses, 1,500 BC. David, 1,000 BC, and the Jerusalem, or the return from the captivity, the time of the captivity, around 500, after 500 BC. So you kind of got four key points to kind of think of your history and where events happen in that timeline back there. But think about that. Abraham's about 2,000. That means for about 2,000 years of Jewish history, God has set the tenor for what he's going to do in the larger picture with them. Some of that's going to change when God gives the law, but that's another study down the road. But the other thing, the takeaway from this in terms of a comparison is Abraham demonstrates this principle that God is not in a hurry with his plan and that God isn't about numbers in his plan. God does things in small ways. In fact, one of my professors, and I think he kind of took the verse out of context as I went back and looked at it, but God, there's actually a verse that said that there's a day coming in which people will despise, they will despise the day of small things. It's one of the statements over in the Minor Prophets, and I don't remember if you remember it, but I went there. But any questions? Okay.